Welcome to the Math Ed Podcast. My name is Sam Otten from the University of Missouri, and today I am joined by Jennifer Roof, who's an assistant professor of mathematics education in the College of Education at the University of Oregon. Jenny, thanks so much for speaking with me.
Well, thanks for inviting me, Sam.
Very happy to be doing this in our, you know, Zoom way. Everything is Zoom now, so this is very normal to be talking in this format. We're going to be talking about Jenny's article in the journal Educational Studies in Mathematics, Volume 104. This is a recent article that's entitled Why Indigenous Languages Matter for Mathematics Education, a Case Study of Itchishkin. So Jenny, this is a very interesting article that really brings in some perspectives from Indigenous language and thinking about how that can inform curriculum and mathematical concepts. So I'm very eager to dig into that article. But on this podcast, I always like to back up for a second and just sort of put you on the map, so to speak. And so I wonder where you did your graduate studies and also what you focused on when you were doing your dissertation research.
Actually, my first year of graduate work was to earn a master's degree at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. And that work happened in 2004, 2005. I was fortunate to be able to take a sabbatical year from my work as a high school math teacher. And it got me excited about graduate school and my work there with Amy Ellis and Eric Knuth in particular. Introduced me to this very new way of thinking about teaching and learning mathematics. I shouldn't say a new way, it was so many new ways. Mm-hmm. And then I had a few more years in the classroom to go out and learn those things and really shift practice. My family and I moved to California, and I had a choice between getting a license for teaching in the state of California or applying for grad school. So I applied for grad school and I got in. My dissertation work, my doctorate, happened at Stanford, and my dissertation was about what we call public sense making. It's classroom-based research. I was working with sixth graders in a large Bay Area, metro area, and their teacher. And we were looking at predominantly like what happens when kids who come in who are used to sort of a set and get kind of instructional practice and learning practice, and they're asked to, invited to, encouraged to, pushed to become more agentic in their learning. And so through that process, which was very collaborative, very discourse driven, and very student centered, we came to term at public sense making. Mm-hmm. And my advisor at Stanford was Jo Boehler.
Okay, people might have heard of her.
Yes, maybe.
So I want to turn now, though, to the article here in Educational Studies in Mathematics. I'm just curious about what you viewed as the purpose of this research, looking at indigenous languages and how that can inform mathematics education. And then how did you find yourself coming into this area of research?
I have long been interested in questions of identity in mathematics, teaching and learning. And when I say identity, that's actually a very broad topic. So I've looked at identity through multiple lenses across the years and across different projects. But for this piece that we're talking about today, the Itchishkin Mathematics Project work, is we're coming from a curricular angle. How can we write materials that center the Yakima language of Itchishkin and Yakima lived experiences and worldviews in a way that children who are coming from an indigenous perspective would see themselves reflected in the curriculum, and children who are coming from a different lived worldview experience would see this valuation of indigenous language and indigenous ways of being. So the goal really is to create a space where mathematics and language and cultural lived experiences are all working in harmony.
And so the specifics of your work is very much tied to that Yakima culture, but then mm-hmm. the sort of spirit or the goals that you have could be transferred to people trying to make mathematics connected and relevant, and also just allow the students to see themselves in the mathematics. That idea could be taken and also pursued in lots of other cultural settings.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, the ideas, the principles behind how we're constructing this curriculum certainly translate to other contexts and settings. But in general, when we think about a mathematics classroom or really any learning environment, do we welcome the learner in as the whole human being that they are, or are they expected to check some part of themselves at the door? And so for children who are perhaps part of the Ichishkin Language Reclamation Project, because Ichishkin is an endangered language, actually, for a variety of reasons. But there is this work to try to revitalize it and to welcome new speakers into the language.
And you were even generating some new words, right? That kind of made sense in the context of the language.
Yeah, that's actually one of the bigger challenges is that there isn't a one-to-one mapping between what you might think of as Western mathematics or even the Common Core State Standards for Mathematics and Yakima cultural experiences and certainly Yakima language. One of the things that I learned, I read so much to be prepared to do this work, and I worked in concert with a very important team of authors, and we'll circle back to that in a moment, I'm sure. But one of the things that I learned was that language, in many ways, reflects the worldview of the people who speak it. And when I say worldview, I mean things like what color is something, or how do you experience certain cultural interactions? And when I say what color is something, I mean, it really gets as deep as the things that we notice and that are important to us as human beings are the things that we attach language to. And so you've probably heard that there are, I forget how many Inuit words for snow. You know, like the quality of snow has a much deeper impact on somebody who lives in a very cold environment and deals with snow all the time. And so it would make sense that you'd have a lot of different words for the different kinds of snow. In that same way, we just didn't find as many fractional words already existing in Ichishkin. We had whole, half, and quarter, but we had to create language so that we could talk about smaller unit fractions in the language of Ichishkin. And that's where the partnerships become so, so critical, because it's not simply a matter of making up a word or coming up with the very best translation that you can, because when you're inventing language to represent something, it needs to honor the worldview and the experiences of the people who speak and who spoke that language initially. So here's where I'm going to talk about the authorship team.
Yeah, great.
So I want you to picture the scene. This work all was born out of a course that I inherited when I started my work here in Oregon in 2016. It's actually K through 5 math content for people who want to become elementary school teachers. That's a whole other story, but that's actually another branch of my research. Mm-hmm. Like how those people, who a lot of whom have had negative experience with mathematics, come to make peace with it and then go on to help other students learn it. So Keith Walker showed up in my very first class, and he was turning in all of his problem sets in both English and Ichishkin. Mm. And they were beautiful. They were works of art. And I just was blown away. I mean, for one thing, he's doing double the work, more than double the work, because he's thinking in English, and as an Ichishkin learner, he's really pushing himself to come up with language to represent all these mathematical concepts. And so when I approached him, I said, these are amazing, and why are you doing this? He said, my goal is to write an Ichishkin mathematics curriculum so that we can teach this in an immersion setting in an elementary school. Now, keep in mind, this school doesn't exist yet. This is work that Keith is doing for a future that has yet to be built. So I started working with Keith on it, and I got pretty excited. And I was like, all right, well, you know, I would love to write about this. Are you up for that? And he said, yeah. And then we started moving forward, and we kept hitting these roadblocks where Keith would say, I can't do this without approval of Virginia Beaver. Now, here's the thing about Virginia Beaver. She is Yakima. She is an Ichishkin speaker from birth. She earned her PhD in linguistics here at the University of Oregon when she was in her late 80s. And she has long been a main proponent of the Ichishkin revitalization program here in the Northwest, in what we now call Oregon and Washington. And she is 98 years old.
This is Sam cutting in after the fact to say that I want to share a little bit of audio of the Ichishkin language. What follow are a few phrases in Ichishkin that are taken from the audio dictionary hosted by the University of Washington. There's a link to the Ichishkin dictionary in the show notes.
Putumt kunipt. Duit ki ikaukena huli anagustun skulilapt. Nach schwersklik diwa ititamat pamapa pinipt kota. O klau au baishwam chau yikatasha kumadash naktochta.
Virginia was a really important research partner for us because Virginia is the tribal elder. And so she is the one who provides sanction and feedback and would often say, no, that's not quite right. That letter doesn't exist in the Ichishkin language. So, for example, when we first proposed calling a generic fraction A over B, we changed it to A over P because the letter B doesn't exist in the Ichishkin alphabet. But then I hit another roadblock because once I realized that I was as a white researcher, I felt like an interloper. I really wasn't sure what was appropriate and inappropriate to share with the world about this work. And so this is where our fourth partner joined our research team. So Michelle Jacob is also Yakima. And she's a full professor here in my department. Michelle saw that I was stuck and she said, do you want me to hop on that paper? And I said, yes, please. So here's the image I would hope we could all hold in our minds. Often in research and in mathematics, you will see power structures that are vertically stacked, where people or objects or ideas that have more power, you can think of as being higher up and being able to exert downward pressure. What we work very hard to do and continue to work hard to do in our research team is to create what I would call a jigsaw practice. And I'm sure I'm borrowing this from somebody. I can't remember who to give them credit for this metaphor. But all of us, all four of us, bring specific kinds of expertise to this conversation. So if we're going to write a mathematics curriculum, I'm proud to be able to talk about how we think about mathematics in a lot of different contexts, and then be able to mesh with the cultural context that Virginia is able to share and the linguistic context that Virginia and Keith are able to share. And Michelle's a really important broker, too, in terms of bringing it all together with her work in Indigenous studies and traditional ecological knowledges. So that was a rather long story to tell you how the work was born and now how it's moved forward and how it's being carried out. So Michelle and I are planning to write for grant funding because we'd really like to continue this work. And in order to do so, we need to be able to pay some people.
It's interesting, though, to hear about that author team, because I look at the article and I see the four names listed, you know, but to hear the dynamics of how Keith, you know, kind of originated this and then bringing Virginia in. And it's interesting to just think about, wow, how much complexity and personality and individuality is behind those names that are just listed at the top of a paper.
Absolutely. Yeah, this is one of the fun parts about getting to do a podcast. And if I might add, the thing I think that makes this all work, first of all, these are all amazing human beings. They're lovely, they're hardworking, they care deeply, they're just nice people to know. But at the bottom of all of this, we all have the same shared goal, which is that we want inclusive, warm, welcoming, rich learning experiences for children, in particular Indigenous children who have been marginalized for centuries, especially in this country, but certainly not only in this country. And so because we all care about the same thing, that gives us a lot of energy to keep the work moving forward.
So I want to go into a little bit of the details of the article. And again, this is an educational studies in mathematics, but you mentioned the class, the content class for elementary pre-service teachers. But I wonder if you could tell us a little bit more about that class and also really what was it that you were working on in terms of the curriculum? Was it certain tasks? Was it certain ideas? Was it certain mathematical concepts? And just help set the stage for us a little bit for that setting.
Well, I halfway hesitate to say this, but I'm going to go ahead and say it anyway. That class I think of as math therapy because so many of our students come to us having had very bad experiences at some point. Not all of them. I'm actually working on another paper right now, and I'm looking at a cohort of 31 students, and having read their essays, there are about three of them that were like, I had a great time in math in elementary school. But 28 of them were like, no, this was really, this piece of it, really, this piece is about time math facts tests in particular. So 28 of the students had a very negative experience in their own past with time math facts tests. That's just one example. But they come to us, and this won't surprise you, it relates to Lonnie Horne's work about good kids, fast kids, lazy kids, slow kids. It's a piece she put out in 2007. The ways that students get labeled in relationship with what we think of traditionally as being good at math, which has been get the right answer, get it fast, don't make mistakes. So my students come to this class thinking that's what it means to be good at math. And so what we do is we spend several weeks unpacking and reframing and moving forward. And we do this by engaging with mathematical content. We're grateful to use a curriculum that comes out of Boston University, very much inquiry-driven, small group, discourse-based. And the course covers all of the mathematical content you would want an elementary school teacher to have some measure of expertise in. And so we spend a fair amount of time really unpacking what is the base 10 number system, for example, what does it mean? Why does it work the way that it does? And then we get into how do children think about addition and subtraction problems coming from a CGI base, cognitively guided instruction, the work that came out of Wisconsin. Same thing with multiplication and division. So we start with much more organic problem solving tasks and we move toward the US standard algorithms, which are often the only things that my students have experienced coming in. And then we unpack why those algorithms work and we reinforce why it's so important to, first of all, never say carry the one. And second, understand what that means and what does that little one mean. So this course runs for 2 quarters, and then the second quarter, we dig deeply into fractions and conceptual knowledge of fractions, which is why actually the Ajishkin Math Project started with fractions, because that's where Keith was digging into really making sense of mathematics and it's translating things into Ajishkin. And we wrap up with a brief foray into geometry and geometric measurement concepts. So if I want my students to have learned only 2 things by the end of those 2 quarters, it is one, that they can make sense of mathematics, and ideally they can make sense of mathematics by struggling with it and talking with other people and listening to, and looking at how other people have made sense of it and building connections across those multiple representations. And 2, that they have this vision of how they might do something similar to this with their own students in the future, so that their own students in the future are going to have a very different experience learning mathematics from any of the damaging experiences that our teachers might have had in their own past. So as you might imagine, as I understand it, you do classroom-based research as well. It's so rewarding to work with people who, you know, it's like they see math in this new way. And you get to watch the light bulbs go off and get all of the lovely course feedback about the positive experiences that the students are having.
I'm speaking with Jenny Roof from the University of Oregon. And so in that setting of this content course for pre-service elementary teachers, what were the Yakima concepts and what were the sort of elements from Yakima culture that you were able to bring in to this setting?
So for Yakima context in particular, that was definitely within the expertise of Virginia Beaver and Michelle Jacob. And so this was one of the very best parts of the whole research team process. We sat in Virginia's living room. It felt intrusive to audio record. And I think this is in the methods section of the paper if anybody cares to read about it. But Virginia told us stories. And this is actually an important part of Indigenous culture, is storytelling from elders. It's the way traditional ecological knowledge is passed down. It's the way that children and younger people are educated. Deep listening is a way of showing respect and gratitude for the gift of the story. In fact, one of Virginia's most recent book is called The Gift of Knowledge, and it is nothing but Virginia, well, it's actually more than Virginia telling stories, but it's primarily Virginia having recorded stories for future generations. So when we started off, Virginia was thinking about where she could remember fractions. And she brought up the context of building teepees in particular. And what I wish I could recreate for you was the deep pride she had in telling the stories of her mother and other women in the tribe who held in their minds all of the necessary engineering and sewing knowledge needed to construct a teepee. How many hides, how long of the material needed to be to make the hoops, the material they used to sew it together. And, you know, the teepees come in different sizes. And so they had to do all this scaling entirely, you know, like using what they were holding in their minds. And then they would create the teepees. And she talked about trading with seafood. So Virginia's people were along the Columbia River. And this is where I have to be very careful because I want to make sure I'm remembering accurately. So here in what we now call Oregon, and the reason I say what we now call Oregon, what we now refer to as Washington, is because these are colonized lands. These were not lands that were willingly given over by the people who lived here. They were taken. And so the names of the states are all colonizing names. They are what the name the land was renamed to be. So with that in mind, tribes who lived along the coast would travel inland and they would trade these strings of big flaked salmon. And they were strung along strips of bark. And you would make your trade on the basis of the fractional length of an arm. And then there would be some calculation based on what the going rate was. And she also talked about pouring water. So Yakima people often gather in longhouses. And in longhouses, meals are shared. And so there is this blessing ceremony when the water is first poured. So you first pour a cup half full, and then everyone says together, "Chush," which is a blessing of the water and the people, as I understand it. And after you've drunk your half cup in this community setting, then you can have a whole cup if you want. This is a story that shows up in Michelle's book, Yakima Rising, which is another great way to learn more about Ichishkin language reclamation and Yakima culture. So those were the stories that Virginia shared with us. And what we realized in talking then was that there's a really pervasive and very damaging fractional notion that has been imposed upon a lot of indigenous, well, for it to be enrolled in an indigenous tribe in the United States, you must demonstrate blood quantum. And as I learn more and write more about it, it's a bit of a fraught space in the sense that blood quantum, as I understand it, has been handed over to tribal groups, meaning that they're now in control of what those definitions are and how they're measured. But what Michelle shared was that historically, the Yakima people did not recognize Yakima or not Yakima. They had no notion of percentage of indigeneity, fraction of indigeneity, fraction of Yakima. When they were forced to sign the treaty at risk, you know, it was sign or genocide. Those were the options. Then there became this fractionation of what it meant to be Yakima, how much Yakima blood did you have, and similarly a fractionation of land. So when the Yakima were moved on to reservations, they were given certain land allotments, which are actually overseen by the federal government, and that's a whole other line of research and what a mess that's been. It's frankly been, centuries of land theft and mismanagement. But one of the issues is that as families grew across generations, the sizes of the land plots did not. And so individual ownership in chunks of land became smaller and smaller fractions and harder to manage. So those were the cultural contexts that arose out of those initial discussions.
And now thinking about those Yakima ideas, how would you incorporate those into the college class, or how would you incorporate those into some mathematics curriculum, for example?
The eventual goal actually is to create curriculum materials that can be used in an immersion setting. And like I said, that school doesn't exist yet. So that's out there in the future. What I can say on a positive note is that what's now known as Washington State and Oregon State. Washington passed, I think it's called the Since Time Immemorial Law around having Indigenous curriculum in schools, and we're following in those footsteps here in Oregon. And so what we're going to start to see is more materials in more classrooms. And of course, it won't surprise anyone that the disciplines that are leading the way are history, social studies, and English language arts. Math is often seen as this culturally neutral and somehow sterile, space. And so it would be great if our materials were part of something like that process. But to be honest, this work moves so slowly that we don't really have the materials yet to be sharing in those ways. And I hadn't actually thought about taking this material into the content classes, but we probably should, just to see what the students' experience with it would be like. And the other place that I think I might want to think about bringing this is our secondary math methods course and our elementary math methods courses, which are other classes that I teach here at the university. We do a lot around task selection and a small amount of curriculum writing in our teacher preparation programs. So it would be interesting to work with a group of up-and-coming teachers to see what they might want to do with it and how they would make sense of it.
I want to now kind of expand outside of your team, but like, what message would you hope to leave with people, even if they're in like a very different context or with different cultural histories around them? But what's the sort of message that you want them to take from this work?
Who is in your room? Look around you. Who are your thought partners? Who are the people that you're working together with? Who are the stakeholders? And who are your learners? Who is it that you're there that all of you are there to support? Because in this world that we're all of us who are here in mathematics education serve at the end of the day one group of people, and that is the students in classrooms. I would ask yourself, what kinds of conversations can you be having? And then the second question I would ask is, what are the power dynamics? And are they equitable? So how can you form your own jigsaw of expertise? And related to that, and this might be the second question actually, what's the problem you're trying to solve? So all of us are, I think that's one of the great joys of being in this work, is that I have an endless array of math problems ahead of me. I have a whole lifetime of problem solving, which is really exciting. So let's reorder that. I'd start with, who's in your room? What's the problem you're trying to solve? And how are you going to create equitable problem-solving community?
Jenny, it's been great talking to you about that work. I have a final question that I like to ask, and this is from a friend of mine, Aaron Brackenecke. Used to ask this all the time when I was in grad school. But I'll ask you, if you were not in math education, could you imagine yourself doing something else as an alternative career?
You know, I'm not sure what it's going to say about me, but you sent me these questions ahead of time, and this is the one I probably spent the most time thinking about.
That happens very often.
And I think it's because, for one thing, I'm pre-tenure. So how do I want to represent myself to the world? I just turned 52. This is my third and a half career. So in the past, when I was 21, a partner and I started our own leather tailoring business. Then I became a math teacher, and I had a side career as an aerial dancer for 12 years. And when I went away to college, or when I went to Stanford, I couldn't keep the aerial work up, so I picked up springboard and platform diving. So I think that's what I would do. If I weren't doing this, it wouldn't be a paying career. But if I think about the thing that, where are the problems I want to solve and what brings me joy? And frankly, what makes me feel like I'm really alive in my body? It's diving. Mm-hmm. So I think that is probably what I would very much like to do.
Either getting pulled up or falling down from heights.
Well, yeah. And so to relate this back to mathematics teaching and learning, a lot of people have so much fear attached to mathematics. Mm-hmm. Not everyone, but a lot of times people have a fear, and they have a fear of failure, I think. And that's for good reasons. I'll never be bored in this work. There's plenty of work to do. Mm-hmm. But if I'm going to ask my students to do things that scare them, I think it's important to have a regular practice in my own life of doing things that scare me. And I will tell you that diving is scary.
Well, Jenny Roof from the University of Oregon. Jenny, it's been wonderful talking to you. Thanks so much.
Yeah, thank you, Sam. And I really appreciate the podcast.
Thank you for listening to the Math Ed Podcast. I started the podcast in 2012, and I am committed to keeping the feed free and maintaining open access to the entire catalog of past episodes. But the hosting fees are coming due this month, and I don't have any university funding or organizational sponsorships for the podcast, so I've always just covered the costs out of my own pocket. Some friends of the podcast have made donations in the past, and that really helps, so I wanted to just quickly ask for your support. I know a lot of people are in tough situations right now, but if you have a few dollars to spare and you have found the show beneficial, then please go to matheded.podomatic.com and click on the PayPal button just below my picture. Anything you donate will go toward the expenses of the podcast. That's matheded.podomatic.com, and thanks again.